These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, the 2007-2008 season brochure, and KrannertCenter.com announcements of the 2007-2008 season of guest artists are now available.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. For a long time now, on a Friday, once a month, we've been talking about personal finance to give people who are listening a chance to call in and ask practical questions about their own financial planning and investment strategies. And we're doing that again this morning. And our guest is Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. And whatever questions people might have, you certainly call in and give us as much background information. And I know Kevin will do his best to help you out. Whenever we do these shows, too, we would like to urge people to say, think very carefully about what you do with your money. Don't just do something because Kevin says so, or Dave Sino says so, or any one person says so. Do your homework, get as many different opinions as possible, but this is one that you can include in your basket of knowledge here, and I know he will do his best to help you out. We do have somebody here who is already ready to go, and anybody else is welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Good to have you here again.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Let's go right ahead. We'll get this caller and someone listening in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just graduated from college about a year ago, and I was wondering if you could give me a little bit of advice about retirement. I work for the university in the state of Illinois, so I'm in the CERS retirement system, but I also have a Roth IRA, and between the two, I've estimated that I'm saving approximately 25% of my annual income for retirement. So considering my age and the fact that I'd like to be thinking about purchasing a home in the near future, I'm wondering if I'm actually saving too aggressively for my retirement, and if I am, if you have any suggestions on better allocation.
Well, first of all, congratulations, and 25% is a tremendous savings. And I also see your point in terms of where you're at in not only your financial stage of life, but also in your career. So let's try to take it piece by piece. The good news is you already have an understanding and have acted on what I would say is the knowledge that putting money away sooner rather than later means that you have a powerful tool of compounding to work in your favor. That's terrific. In terms of the allocation and then more near-term goals, buying a house, for example, putting all of the savings as you are, using the 25% number, if it's going into a tax-qualified retirement plan, such as the afforded to everyone with a Roth IRA, a regular IRA, or some similar things, those are probably things that you might have to, I would say, back off on a little bit.
Okay.
There's no better way to save for things like down payment for a house purchase than things like good old bank instruments, passbook savings accounts, certificate of deposits, those types of things. And again, the reasons are because you don't get a tax break in doing so, but you obviously have a whole lot greater flexibility and access to the money if you find a house and need the money for the downstroke.
And I understand that after you've had a Roth IRA for 5 years, you can take I believe it's $10,000 out of that to make an initial down payment on a home as a one-time thing. Would you recommend doing that?
My personal bias is not to do that. Again,
okay.
The Roth IRA does have some flexibilities built into it. Those have changed over time, actually gotten to be a little bit more flexible. You did point out the five-year window, the five-year time clock. That's still a very important thing. So it's important that a person starts a Roth IRA to get that time clock ticking. If you've done that, that's terrific. But again, I would use the Roth IRA in a part of a retirement planning process more so than for downstroke on a house.
Okay.
Let me just back up a minute now and make sure I understand. When you said 25%, are you including the component that goes into the State University Retirement Program from your pay?
Yes.
Okay. Then I'll caution you on that and say, although it's good that you're saving the amount you are, that's a good habit to form. Don't forget that that's a conscripted form of savings. You have no choice there.
Right.
And as an employee of the university, you are putting money into that system in lieu of, instead of, Social Security taxes. So the bottom line is, I would say that that component is a given. You basically are going to say that that's going to be a payment in lieu of a payment out of the Social Security system. The funding also goes to the providing of the health insurance that we all work under at the university. And that's a component of the conscripted savings that's going into SERS, too. So the bottom line is, although 25% might be a true number as a percent of total income, you know, I would say take that 9% off the table.
Okay.
You're going to be putting money into some retirement savings program by force, whether you're in the private or the public sector.
Okay.
So don't assume that that's something over and above. I mean, that's a requirement.
Right. So you would perhaps back off a little bit on the retirement savings, you said, on the IRA?
Well, I would back off in a sense of reallocating some of those monies into things that are just after-tax savings vehicles. Again, with bank or credit union, money that's more accessible. If you're specifically saving for either a rainy day fund or the eventual down payment on the purchase of a house.
Okay, and my only other question is, what advice do you have about money markets? I currently have my emergency fund in a money market, and I was wondering if you think that's the best place for that.
I presume you mean money market mutual fund, or do
yes.
you mean a money market account at a bank?
Mutual fund.
A money market mutual fund is a way a person can get perhaps a little bit higher rate of interest. I would caution you and just make sure that it's a money market mutual fund that is two things. Number one, sponsored by a reputable, long-standing, good reputation type of mutual fund company, because there are literally thousands of these things out there.
Okay.
And the second thing is make sure that the portfolio of assets that they manage are things that truly reflect what you could consider to be as little risk as possible, because those types of emergency funds really shouldn't have any amount of investment risk in them at all. There are some money market mutual funds that have some juicy looking yields that invest in short-term money market type instruments, but of a very low credit quality. And we just don't need to have our rainy day money go away with some hiccup in the economy.
Right. Well, thank you very much for your advice.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Let's talk next with someone in Des Plaines up near Chicago. This is line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if I could ask a question concerning do you have a report on how the couch potato portfolio is doing?
No, I'm sorry. I haven't updated Dave Sinnoh's portfolio for him. I figured that was going to be a treat for his return.
I see. Is that scheduled for next month?
As far as I know, I think the Dave will be back again next month. I think he was just going to be gone for 2 months, and Kevin was going to do these two shows. So, yes, I think you expect to see him then. And, yes, I would expect him to do that, and then we would post it on the website.
Also, we'll be available on the website.
Yeah, yes, we certainly would do that.
And,
yeah.
And if I may, do you have an opinion in connection with a purchase of, let's say, a vacation home at this time, in the specifically in the state of Michigan? And at this time of the rough housing market, do you have an opinion on that?
Well, in any marketplace, it's always good to be a buyer when everyone else is a seller. It's always good to be a seller when everyone else is a buyer.
Yeah.
You know, that's whether it's real estate, stocks, bonds, whatever. I mean, that's just, you know, a good thing to consider.
Yeah.
Whether or not the real estate market itself, and now I'm talking literally across the country, coast to coast, whether or not it has stabilized, there's probably as much evidence to say that it has not, and there might be a little bit more weakness in that sector of our economy. Really doesn't even answer your question or come close to it. Again, from a sense of where do you want to buy a place that you want to live, whether it's permanently or only part of the year, has as much in making that decision as anything. there are areas where you're going to find a lot less visibility in the actual weakness of the housing prices. And visibility is what drives the price in any market. In other words, if most of the houses in a particular area in Michigan that you're interested in eventually owning a vacation house happen to be owned by people who have owned the houses for quite some time and continue to want to, the price in that marketplace may not be impacted whatsoever by what's going on in the economy. Bottom line is, if you've identified an area where you think you want to be a home buyer, then I would say the better thing to do is, like any other type of illiquid marketplace, which I put real estate in that category, try to get to know your neighbors. Eventually, you'll have to interact with them anyway, so you better get to know them sooner rather than later. Make them aware of your interest in a house in that area, and then it's a word-of-mouth situation. Rather than waiting for something to be listed with a realtor, if they know that you're an interested buyer and you're patient, they basically say, well, you know, Smiths want to sell their cottage, so get a hold of the Smiths.
I see. Okay. Well, that's good advice. I wouldn't have thought of that. Thank you very much.
All right. You're welcome. Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome here. This is our monthly program on personal finance. Kevin Waspy is the guest this time around. He's a lecturer of finance at the College of Business at the U of I. So if you have investment questions, you can give us a call. When the first caller called in and she said that she was saving 25% of her income, I think you and I both thought, whoa, that's
very
good. That's a big number. And then although I think even if you take out the contributions to the state university retirement system, she's still, I would say, compared with a lot of Americans, she's still doing pretty well if she actually is saving that much.
Absolutely.
Is there some kind of suggested percentage where one would say to people, if you could, at least at this much level, that would be a good thing to shoot for?
As a percentage, I couldn't give you an actual number. So much of trying to quantify it would literally break it down into where does the money go, for what purpose is it suited, and what age are we talking about this process beginning? She's saving a tremendous amount of money for the purpose of retirement at her age, at her stage of her career. Now, that's not a bad thing, but I would say she's an oversaver for the purpose of retirement. Again, I wanted to point out that the roughly 9% of her figure was conscripted savings, meaning she has to. Okay, that's just there. And the reason I wanted to take that off the table was because anybody who tells themselves that they are saving money for retirement by virtue of paying Social Security income tax tax on their income to Social Security, or having money taken out of their pay through a conscription program like the State University Retirement Program, or something that's non-voluntary, I think they're kidding themselves. Okay? So I would point out to her or any other university employee that on top of CSRS, there is the ability a person has to put money into their retirement process voluntarily through a 403B arrangement. In the private sector, many, many, many employees have an opportunity to voluntarily take money out of their pay and put it into a 401K plan. Those are the kinds of things, along with regular and Roth IRAs, that I would say are voluntary savings programs. And now we can talk about the notion of not how much is a percentage, but how much we form a savings versus consuming pattern. And here's what I would say. Save until it hurts. Yeah. Save until it hurts, because you will adjust your lifestyle to a level of disposable income. If you don't save that money, you will adjust your lifestyle to having more consumable income. And guess what? You'll consume it.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the fact, and there's certainly been some reporting here. I know we've had stories on the station about the fact that Chrysler and the UAW are going into contract talks. And one of the things that has been increasingly difficult, a contentious issue, is employee benefits, that the company is finding it increasingly difficult to pay the benefits. And, of course, the workers want to continue to maintain as much as possible. And certainly retirement costs and health care costs are big things for that company and for a lot of other companies. I guess it just what it makes me think of is that we're going to certainly see continuation of a trend that we've already seen to moving away from defined benefit plans. There aren't in the private sector, probably there's going to be anybody in a plan like that anymore pretty soon. It's going to be you're going to be expected to do that for yourself, and that there will be vehicles to do that. And maybe if you're lucky, the company will contribute something. We may even get to the point where a company isn't even contributing anything to that, that it's all on the worker. So it's going to be a thing where people are going to have to be doing this for themselves. And certainly the advice is as soon as you start your work life, start that day.
Absolutely.
Don't wait.
Absolutely. And I think the point you make in bringing it to today's talks with Chrysler, excuse me, a little bit of this has been, this is a good news, bad news story. This has been a development ongoing in our economy for 30 years, but a little bit like seeing a comet headed toward the implosion with your planet. We might track its trajectory for 30 years, but no one gets alarmed until it gets within view. At that time, it's a little late. So we've seen a trend in our economy for 30 years easily, where more and more of the responsibility of employees to save for their future has been shifted to their burden. That's not going to change. As we're seeing today, some of the things that are coming out are going to make it more obvious. So the comet's getting closer. Whether you're starting your career midpoint through your career or even coming close to your career, if you have not been saving and funding your retirement, an opportunity to replace your income after the paycheck ends, it's never too late to start. And the earlier you start, the better off. And again, save until it hurts. Because if you depend on someone else, I'm telling you that it's going to be a sad, sad result.
We have a number of callers here, so let's get back to it. And next, we'll talk with someone in Southern Illinois on our line 4. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for your time. I inherited recently $10,000, and it was in a diamond fund. And I'm 61. I'm going to be getting retired or Social Security at 62, and the Diamond Funds is only paying like 1.5% or something a year. And I wanted your advice on what I might put it in that I can have access to money. I have other investments my husband does, but this was just a small fund that I was, small amount of money I wanted to invest. And I was thinking of a friend has an American Funds and they have a 5.75% initial sales charge that declines as the amount increases, the amount invested increases. Is that a good deal or no?
I'm not familiar with the fund that you mentioned where the money is currently in when you say a diamond.
The Diamond Trust, it follows the Dow Jones. It's just.
Oh, okay, diamonds. I'm with you now. Basically, an index type of fund. It follows the performance of the Dow Industrial Average.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I'm with you. There's nothing wrong about an investment in equities for long term growth. I guess the question I would ask first to begin this is: do you prefer growth or do you prefer income? Would you rather have something a little bit less exciting that produces a steady flow of income, or would you rather have something tucked away that you really don't even want to look at in terms of what it's worth, but hope that another 10 years down the road it's worth more?
I would like to get the maximum I can out of the investment.
Okay, well, I want my cake and I want to eat it too, but now that we've established that,
as far as the risk involved?
Well, I meant in a sense of saying, do you want this thing to produce income flow to you while you use that to help you in retirement, or would you rather say that it's money that you just hope grows to become more 10 years from now?
I'm thinking of dividing it half and half. I know that's a small investment, but I have other investments. I do need some money now just for travel and et cetera.
Okay. Then if you want to divide it half and half, leave half where it's at and take the other half to your bank. You could set up a passbook savings account. You've already got one, more than likely. You could look at certificates of deposits. You could structure CDs in what we've talked about before in this program called a ladder of maturities. You tend to get higher rates of return over time. You tend to have regular access to your money. And it's all insured deposits, so there's, you know, no risk of loss.
So you don't advise mutual funds?
Well, I see no purpose in paying a commission. The fund that you mentioned with the front-end load that declines based on how much money you put in, those are called breakpoints in the commission schedule, by the way. There may not be anything wrong with them for a person who goes to an advisor who is starting them out on a financial plan and suggests that for a long-term investment they make that type of purchase. But I will tell you that paying a commission just for the privilege of doing what I think you want to do has no purpose.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell me what the couch potato investing is?
No, I'm sorry, ma'am. We had a caller in earlier who asked about that, and we pointed out that I don't really want to steal Dave Sinnoh's thunder.
I don't want to know what it's doing. I just wanted to know what you're referring to. Is it... advice that he's giving?
Yes, it's a portfolio that Dave set up, and it's a mix of various kinds of mutual funds, and it's on our website. You can go there, and it shows basically what kind of funds we're talking about, what the allocation he suggested, and so out of every dollar, how many cents go into each one of these things.
I see.
He has been updating it to show what the return has been. He's been doing that every month. But since he hasn't been here for a couple of months, the last time it was updated to show that would have been 2 months ago. But it is actually on the website, so at least you could see what the where it is he's suggesting to put the money. And the idea is that it provides good diversification, good return, and at the same time, it's the kind of thing where you don't have to. It's not going to keep you up nights. You put your money in there, and then you contribute to it on a regular basis, and then you forget about it. That's kind of the idea.
I'll look it up on the website.
Yeah, do that.
I really appreciate you having Fridays doing the financial advising, and I thank you for your advice.
All right. Well,
thank you.
We have, as our guest here in this part of Focus 580, Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer of finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. We've been doing the show for quite a long time here, once a month, always on a Friday, to take questions on investing and money management. Usually Dave Sinnoh is here, but he's been taking a little time off, and he asked Kevin if he would come over and do the show, and he said, sure. He's been here a number of times over the years, and we're happy to see him. It's the same kind of deal. If you have questions about investing and financial strategies, call us and give us the information, and Kevin will tell you what he thinks. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next is someone here in Urbana, where we are, line one.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
I have a question about exchange-traded funds. I'd like Kevin's take on those. If you're kind of oriented toward a spectrum of indexed mutual funds from Vanguard, would you want to consider ETFs to include them? I noticed that Vanguard has started to come up with some of its own ETFs. What do you think?
I really don't see a need to do that. An exchange-traded fund is just another way to pool investors' money and then use that to access a portfolio of securities. As you pointed out, Vanguard Mutual Funds, the second largest mutual fund company in the world, really has a sampler of mutual funds that accomplish about any purpose you can imagine. Vanguard is also the company that's built their success on very low expense ratios within the funds. The only thing that I would say you gain, and I put that in really loose terms because I don't really see the advantage, is the ability to watch the value of it change tick by tick, like the price of an individual security, as opposed to seeing a net asset value calculated at the end of a day. You know, that just doesn't excite me, and it doesn't really provide any, it doesn't add anything to the process that I would call investment.
Okay.
An exchange-traded fund trades just like a stock. Literally, we see the stock price change minute by minute as trades are committed. That is the way an exchange-traded fund works. You're buying shares listed on some exchange, usually the American Stock Exchange, where most of them trade. A mutual fund with, again, most of them, at the end of the day, the manager of the fund prices all of the assets in the portfolio. The fund company then publishes the net asset value or value per share of that fund. You have daily liquidity as opposed to moment-to-moment liquidity. Again, none of these features add any value to the process called investing. You don't need that kind of liquidity. You don't need that kind of visibility. As a matter of fact, if it's truly an investment, you ought to look at its value maybe once every 3 months, and that's good enough.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure, you're
thanks
welcome.
For the call. You know, Kevin, I'm looking here at the at Dave's Couch Potato portfolio, and if people want to look at this, what you want to do is go to our website, which is WILL.UIUC.EDU, click on AM, then click on Focus 580, then click on Links, and it will come up. And actually, here it says that it was updated on the 15th of this month, and I don't know if maybe Dave called in the information, I'm not sure, but what it says is it was updated July 15th, and you can, again, see where it is that he's suggesting that the money go, and also what it says is the return year-to-date for the total portfolio as of July 15th up 9.27%, and that compares to the return year-to-date for the S&P 500. That was only 7.4. So we're outperforming the S&P 500.
Well, that's a good thing. I know that I have talked with Dave a couple of times over the summer. I know that he's very much in touch with, and I know that he probably has let someone in the front office know. So if they're updating that on the web page, that's perfect. That's beautiful.
It could be. Yeah, I know that it's something we have tried to make sure that we do every month. And usually what he does is when he comes in here, he brings the new numbers and then talks about them on the air. And then also we make sure that that gets on the website. So, again, if you're interested in taking a look at this, Dave's Couch Potato Portfolio, just go to the website. It's WILL.UIUC.EDU. That's the basic address for all of the stuff on the website. Then click on AM and on Focus 580 and on Links, and it will come up. And it will show you where the assets are allocated and the performance there. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. This is the monthly show that we've been doing now for a long time to talk about investing and money management, and for a long time Dave Sino has been the guest, stopping by here once a month, always on a Friday. He teaches in the business school, but he's taken a couple of months off this summer and asked if Kevin would be willing to step in and be the guy to do the show, and he said sure. And he's certainly been with us before. He's kind of our number two guy when it comes to the money management and investing show. Kevin is a lecturer of finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. So all you need to do is, if you have a question for us, you can give us a call here in Champaign-Urbana. The number, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Folks, we do also have that toll-free line. So that means that if it would be a long-distance call for you, calls on us. That's 800-222-9455. And we have some other callers here. Next up, we'll talk with someone in Chicago. Line number two. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm a little late to the show, so you'll forgive me if I seem like a novice. But as someone who worked in the 1960s and thought $3 an hour was a good salary, I just was mind-boggled by the salaries that they talk about these people in the automobile industry making. When you put the medical thing and all together, $75 an hour, did I hear that right?
That is the figure that's being used when all of the benefits on top of the hourly wage are included.
Well, what's the hourly wage?
Don't quote me on the number, but the last article that I read was roughly $26 an hour.
Whoa. My goodness, if I'd have got that when I started working, I'd have been dancing in the streets.
Well, no. I don't want to disagree with you, but I'll point out that in the 1960s, that $3 bought a heck of a lot more, too.
It certainly did, and I thought I was lucky to have that job, and I worked in the darkroom for quite a while as a darkroom technician, and I thought I was in seventh heaven. But what I'd like to know from you, sir, is if you're making $26 an hour, how do you convince that person to go that if he wants to keep his or her job, to go down to $10 an hour or something like that?
Well, I think you've pretty much hit the nail on the head with so many of the troubles in the auto industry at the moment. The auto industry has, like many heavy manufacturing, union-dominated type of industries, really work themselves into a situation where they have a lot of costs that have been growing over a long number of years. We can blame management, we can blame the union, we can blame, you know, the blame is not going to help anyone. But that's the $64,000 question you've just asked. How do we get some competitive influence into a cost of labor necessary to keep a company in operation?
Well,
I think it's a question that needs to be asked not only of rank and file, but also of white collar. If you're amazed about what the union wage and the cost on a per hour basis for fringe benefits is, you ought to ask what the white-collar workers are making and what kind of fringe benefits there are there. I mean, some of that information is disclosed in the company's filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission, but we only really see the tip of the iceberg in a sense of the high-ranking officers of the firm.
Oh, yes, I would imagine so. If these guys, if you count the medical benefits, and they're pulling out $75 an hour if you count all that stuff in, and they're personally taking $26 an hour home every hour, the white-collar people upstairs in the office must be riding the gravy train.
Well, I would say that there are some issues that need to be addressed in the white-collar workforce as much as in the rank-and-file labor force. The other thing I would point out is this. Much of those costs that we see in there are a calculation of the accrued benefits under a defined benefit pension plan and the accrued funding for them. In other words, the promises that are made under a defined benefit pension plan where a person retires at a certain percent of their pay after X years of service, and the value of the assets in that fund that are there needed to make those payments in the future. That same type of calculation applied to a pension or a retirement plan annuity payment are also applied to the annuity form of payments promised and again assumed based on health care. Some of the health care issues that affect our entire society drive those numbers. So when we all try to bring it back into a dollars and cents per hour number, remember two things. Number one, there's a lot of economic influence in those numbers aside from and maybe even outside of the control of management or labor. The second thing to remember is there's a lot of estimation going on in there. Can we talk about changing some of the conditions and features of the health care plans themselves? Yeah, I think it's necessary to put all of those things out on the table. For instance, there ought to be an incentive in those health care plans for people to manage efficiently those resources. Things like co-pays and deductibles that are not present in many union health plans need to be discussed. That's a way to have the consumer of health care services more in touch with their actual cost. So it's a great question. You and I and, you know, whoever's interested in it could have a wonderful long conversation over a couple of adult beverages.
Oh, yes. I think some people are going to have to change their lifestyle.
Well, it's going to require compromise and a change in expectations on everybody's part. And I think, like any other circumstance of a complex nature, if everybody's a little bit open-minded and they're willing to give up a little bit, then compromise can make it work. If everybody,
if you're making $26 an hour, besides the medical and all the rest, it's going to be very difficult to convince that person.
Well, again, I mean that's a process of negotiation, and I don't claim to have any or all of the answers, but I think it's going to require an open mind on all fronts to be able to discuss these things, and it's not going to be easy. You're right.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll continue, and we'll go next to a caller here, line number 3, and that's someone listening in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah, first, the woman who called with the $10,000, I think that it's at least $30,000 to get, if I recall previous conversations, to get into that, that fund, the couch potato one. I think you need $30,000 at least.
Oh, in terms of if she wanted to take a portion of her 10 and move it into the couch potato?
Right.
Oh, I really don't think she was asking about the couch potato fund as it related to her $10,000. I think that was a question at the end of the discussion of her $10,000. She was just curious when she heard a previous caller ask about how the couch fund potato was doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or maybe you might give her some idea, maybe some kind of part within that. Just a general question. I guess I get concerned about Wall Street sometimes in terms of the greed. Or I guess I look at it as greed. But, you know, for example, like the newspaper industry that has good margins, but they don't have the growth, so there's pressure. Do you think that's going to change in Wall Street at all, or is it just going to be always on growth and how much money that can be made, I guess? I don't know. Or is that the way capital works?
Well, you brought up a couple of interesting points. Let me start with greed. First of all, we live in a system where we are rather capitalistic. If you wanted to say fear and greed are the primal emotions that drive capitalism, you wouldn't get a lot of disagreement out of me. Now, greed for greed's sake is not what I mean, but the notion of doing something because we get personal gain is a cornerstone of capitalism. So now in applying it to whether it's the newspaper industry or any other investment sector on Wall Street, newspapers are in a transitionary phase. Perhaps you, like I, like to pick up a piece of paper that has newsprint on it and get our hands a little smudged and actually have it to hold. I've got to tell you that there's an entire generation that's coming up behind us. I don't know what letter they're identified by now, but I can tell you that if they can't get it online, they're lost. What we're seeing in the newspaper industry is a change in that technology. And I think we're seeing the beginnings of a consumer revolution where a lot of people don't value buying a newspaper anymore. They would instead go to some online site, many of them offering information contained in newspapers for free. That's what's going on Wall Street. So whether it's the Tribune companies, the Wall Street Journal, or any others, the moral of the story is, how do these companies continue to grow? Growth is the key value or the key driver in the value of any asset.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. To another caller here, someone on a cell phone. This is line 1. Hello?
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Just more of an observation and a comment than a question. I've been a self-employed tax accountant for about 25 years in this area, and maybe it's my observation is weighted because we are in a rural sector, but I sign about 400 tax returns a year, and my observation is that people, I can count on about one hand the number of people that have net worths in excess of $1 million that made it through mutual funds and stocks, but I don't have enough fingers and toes to count those excessive net worths got in real estate. And so I just question the use of mutual funds and equities to try to provide a retirement income when at least in my observations, real estate has been a lot better off for these people.
I don't.
I think I'll hang up and listen on that. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for the call. Yeah.
No disagreement there at all. As a rate of return on an asset class, real estate has done tremendously in the recent past. Real estate over the long term has a higher rate of return. And here's the problem. Real estate has a rate of return higher than many asset classes because it has a whole handful of risks that those other asset classes don't have. I don't think the gentleman in 25 years experience preparing and signing tax returns for clients will deny that if somebody wants to sell a stock, a bond, or a mutual fund that holds either, they could probably get cash for it the next day, whereas a sale of real estate might take a little longer. And that's just one small example. So liquidity is something that real estate does not have. Real estate is also, an asset class that makes sense for some. It may not make sense for funding any or all of a part of an average wage earner's retirement package, though. Again, what I'm thinking about is real estate in many instances has an ability to grow in value based on sweat equity. If you don't have the inclination or the talent to go unstop the sink or unplug the toilet at midnight for your tenant, then you know you don't want to be there. If you think you're going to make money because you're going to hire somebody to do those things for you, well, then welcome to another level of expenses. And now if we think about farm ground, then I'll just go right back to the person's mention of 25 years experience predominantly in a rural setting. And I will say, yes, if I were blessed by inheriting farmland, I too would be very wealthy, but I didn't. If I'd gone out in 1982 and bought farm ground in Champaign County, McLean County, or wherever, at that market price then, on borrowed money, I long since would have had that ground repossessed because the cash flows would not have serviced the interest expense on that investment. So there's no bias I have against real estate, but there's no favoritism I show it either. I have to recognize what it's good for, how it works, and the higher risks involved tell me that I should expect a higher rate of return. Is it better than a mutual fund? No. Is it worse than a mutual fund? No. It's different.
And I suppose if you are going to be a mutual fund investor, but you also want to have some of your money going into real estate, you could put your money into a REIT, a real estate investment trust, and thereby enjoy some of the advantages of both being in real estate and yet not being a direct investor. That is, you're not going to own the property yourself.
And that is a great mention you've made. There are different investment vehicles that allow a person to put smaller sums of money into diversified portfolios of assets that might fulfill in an asset class sense. So, yeah, no slam on real estate. Certainly no slam on agricultural real estate. But again, I was in the business in the 1970s, and I saw people buy farm ground, good black dirt in central Illinois. And they bought it at the peak price, and they bought it with borrowed money, and they lost it. Right. And you know what? Farm ground's near a new peak price again, and you know, I just don't like to drive using the rearview mirror looking forward.
Also, just to pick up on a comment of one of the other callers, and it's what he says is certainly correct about something like Dave's portfolio, that for many investors, if people were thinking about doing that, it might be a challenge because mutual funds, I think most of them, do require some initial minimum investment. And in some cases, it could be a couple $1,000s. So if you were going to set up a portfolio like that, I think that it's correct that you might have to have some significant capital to start. Mm-hmm. Now, the one I think, and you can correct me on this, the one advantage that people, for example, working for the university have, being able to go into a 403B and be able to put their money in mutual funds, is I think that the funds have waived the requirements for the minimum contributions. So if you're lucky enough to be able to be in a set up a that is a retirement plan, a savings retirement plan.
Right.
You don't have to worry about that. But if you were just a regular person and you said, okay, I want to set up one of these things, then yeah, that's true. You're going to have to deal with whatever the minimum initial contributions required by the people who operate the fund would be, and that you right. could be talking about $20,000 or $30,000.
That's a very good thing to point out, and I would also extend it to say that many employees in the private sector, where their businesses offer a 401k plan, once you take that into the employer-sponsored setting, most of those mutual funds also have the similar. In other words, if they have a minimum initial investment, that's waived through the 401k plan. So those are good things that a person can look at in terms of perks afforded them through these opportunities to save money.
Yeah, I guess they're thinking that if you're really going to get into it and make a commitment where you're going to put in money on a regular basis, every mm-hmm. money going to come up from your paycheck and go into their mutual fund every
right.
month, they figure, okay, they'll be okay. They'll make, over the long haul, they'll be happy having you as an investor. And so
oh,
they'll
sure.
say, okay, we won't worry about that initial
sure. And it is the aspect of a group plan. So they know that when they're talking to a sponsor, a private sector employer, a manufacturing company that has 100 employees, they know that that money is going to be substantial just by virtue of each employee putting a little something in. Yeah. So it's not uncommon that those minimums are waived.
We have a couple minutes left. You know, one of the things way back before we even got going, I said, well, and you might say something about the new high that the Dow hit this week. And, over certainly we got ups and downs, we have corrections, but the trend overall has been for the Dow to trend higher, even though I'm sure if we went back to a certain point, people would say they would never have believed that it would go as high as it has.
Mm-hmm.
So having said all that, I guess I find myself wondering, well, so what? Okay, so it hit a new high. Well, so what? Does that really matter? And are we in fact expecting it, given again the fact that there will be ups and downs, that the trend over time it will just continue to go up?
Yeah, good questions. As you know, yesterday's close above 14,000 for the first time is not an event in and of itself, but in perspective, I think you've pointed out something that basically financial markets in this country have done pretty well over the past 12, 18, 24 months. They've done pretty well for the first 8 months, 7 months of this year. If we believe that those financial markets are indicative of economic strength, then I think that's what it's telling me is our economy tends to be a little bit stronger than what many people would like to believe it actually is. For instance, whether we're watching or listening on the news to the Fed's inquisition under Humphrey Hawkins' testimony the past 2 days, or anything related to worries about the subprime mortgage area. You know, all of the little pockets of worry are always there. I'm not saying that we should ignore them, but I think on balance, what the stock market's been telling us is the economy is pretty healthy. It's probably healthier than what many headline stories would lead us to believe.
We will try to get one more caller in here, if we can. Line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. In comparison of the stocks and real estate, don't forget a little matter called taxes. My taxes are going up at 10% or more a year, and then there's a myriad of other things. There's insurance. There's the recycling tax. There's the sanitary tax. Don't forget... I can't even remember some of the other taxes, but I remember them when I see them. So, yeah, I just wanted to comment on that. Thank you.
That's Fine. A very
well,
good point.
There are costs that come with being a property owner, no matter what kind of property is you're
right.
talking about.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we're just about the point we have to finish up. Any last sort of thought you'd like to leave with folks?
No, I'd just like to say that it's always a pleasure for me to come talk with the callers that have questions. It's a great service that I think WILL offers, the ability people to call in, get different viewpoints. And as you started out this morning with our segment, That's the important thing. Get a sense of perspective from different people and don't follow any one simple formula. Don't follow any one simple suggestion. You need to do this. Because, again, it's not troubling and it's not tremendously crushing, but a little bit of homework and you can make sound decisions. It's not brain surgery.
Well, I thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Kevin Wasby, he's a lecturer of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. We do these shows once a month. He's been sitting in for the last couple of months for Dave Sinnoh, who is also in the College of Business, and I think we'll be seeing him again next month. One way or another, somebody will be here to do this program with us and give you the opportunity to ask questions. Our show, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 25th anniversary of offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign Urbana. Bodywork Associates now has an office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. Coming up next time on the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn will be having another conversation with writer John Katz, who has written a lot of books about, particularly about dogs and living with dogs and the kind of animals that they are and how we interact with them. And you will hear more in the Afternoon Magazine interview today about life at his place that he calls Bedlam Farm. There are three border collies, Rose, Izzy, and Emma. There are a couple of yellow labs. There's a cat. They have some steers. There's some donkeys. There's chickens. There's a flock of sheep and a couple of humans, one of whom is John Katz. And it's a lot of fun when he's on the show. He's got a new book out about living with all these animals, and he'll be talking with Celeste Quinn about that in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. The show itself gets underway at noon here on AM 580 with the usual mix of news and features and sports and what have you. Of course, we'll also have weather and an opportunity along about 12:35 to get a weather forecast if you are going to be traveling. Mike Sola will be there, and all you have to do is call in and tell us where you're going, and Mike will give you a weather forecast for your destination. That's all coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine today here on AM 580 starting at noon. In the next hour of this Focus 580, we'll be talking, this issue of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the issue of immigration reform and why it is continuing to be so difficult and contentious. We'll talk with Kathleen Campbell Walker. She is an attorney who works in Texas and also happens to be currently the president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. So that'll be in the next hour of the show. First, though, we'll take a break, as we usually do, for news and update on the markets, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. Let's jump right in and look at the commodity prices at the Chicago Board of Trade, Kansas City, and Merck at midday. September wheat in Kansas City now trading 6.12.5 up 5.75. December 6.26 up 4.5. September wheat at the Board of Trade of 6.20 is unchanged. December 6.34 now 6.35 down a quarter. March of next year, 6.39 up 1.5. September corn, 3.24 up 2.75. December, 3.39 up 2.75. March, 3.54.5.